Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
So I think the biggest challenge that people face is that we are very good at seeing short-term consequences. And this is the way that our brain works, by the way. And we're very poor at seeing the long-term consequences of our actions. Because even for the person who is using marijuana, if you ask them what's wrong in your life right now, they'll say that XYZ is wrong, but the marijuana doesn't appear to have a direct effect on that. And that's the biggest problem.
I'm Doug Bopes, personal trainer, best-selling author, and entrepreneur, and I'm on a mission to help others become the best version of themselves. So I'd like to welcome you to the Adversity Advantage podcast, where we will help you use obstacles, failures, and setbacks to give you that edge needed for success. I'll be interviewing people from all walks of life on how they overcame trials and turned them into triumphs. So please, sit back, relax, and get ready to be absolutely blown away by some of the wisdom and stories you're about to hear.
Welcome back to another episode of The Adversity Advantage. I'm your host, Doug Bopes, and today's guest is Dr. K. Dr. K is a Harvard-trained psychiatrist specializing in modern mental health for the digital generation. He's the president and co-founder of Healthy Gamer, a mental health platform that provides content, expert wellness coaching, and community to young people. He has inspired millions of people with online content while overseeing the mental health coaching of thousands of young people. He is widely regarded as the foremost expert on video game addiction and the most prominent mental health authority for young people. Today on the show, we discuss why are so many people struggling with emotional pain and addiction right now, how things like social media, porn, and video games can be the ultimate connection trap, why you must learn to control your emotions so they don't get the best of you, what is most misunderstood about men's mental health and why we must do better moving forward, the remedy for freeing yourself from various addictions in the prison of your emotions, why success can be addictive and lead to more unhappiness, and so much more. So let's get this conversation going and welcome Dr. K to the Adversity Advantage podcast. Dr. K, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
I'd love to jump right in. I'd love to get your thoughts on like why are things like weed, porn, alcohol, and Netflix so alluring to people that have deep-rooted emotional pain?
That's such a complex question. I'd say globally, you said something about, what was it? Something about pain, like deep-rooted emotional pain.
Yeah.
So I think the number one reason that all these things are rising is actually because there's a blindness to our internal emotional experience. So a lot of people aren't even aware of their deep-rooted emotional pain. In fact, that's half the problem. So the situation right now is that we're going through life and our attention is externalized way more than it ever has been. So when I was like a medical student, I was so focused on productivity. So I would like listen to a podcast, right? Like healthy podcasts, like good podcasts, like this one, where I'm going to learn something. And then I would do that while I was like, cooking or cleaning in the morning. And then I'm listening to a lecture on my way to the train and I'm reading stuff on the train. And then I'm getting distracted on my cell phone. And then I'm listening to a lecture. The whole day, our mind is outside of ourselves. And we have such good ways to numb our internal emotional environment. And if you look at everything that you mentioned, the one common neuroscience or one of the common neuroscience pathways is that they suppress our negative emotional circuitry. So when I'm feeling bad, if I watch pornography, it'll make those feelings go away temporarily. Social media will do it. Getting caught up in a show will do it. Playing video games will do it. Marijuana will do it. So what's actually happening is we are numbing ourselves to our emotional problems. As we numb ourselves to our emotional problems, those problems pile up. And then we need more numbing agents. So this is why we're seeing not just people getting dependent on one thing, but we see that the average person is utilizing all of these things way more. And that's because of this cycle of not actually dealing with things like emotionally or even problems in our life that create emotions, right? We just have numbing agents. We engage in a lot of avoidance. So we're seeing all of the things that allow us to avoid while still enjoying ourselves right? Because normally when I avoid my problems, it creates problems, and it does create problems. But this way I can forget about them for a few hours at a time. And then I can switch to something else and forget about that for a few hours at a time. And so I think that's kind of the big global impact.
And all these things that we've talked about are so normalized now. Marijuana, alcohol, I mean, screens, porn. And I feel like a lot of times what happens is people are okay with using these because there's no like short-term problems that come from these things. Like, I mean, most people in the short term, their life isn't going to fall apart from using these things. But I know long-term, they can be very detrimental. Like, what is your message to people that are casually using these things to check out from their life and dealing with the internal stuff? Like, what are they not aware of?
I think, like you said, so if it's a long-term consequence, so let me ask you, Doug, if it's a long-term consequence, let's say I start using marijuana today, and 4 years from now, I'm stalling in life, right? So we see this picture a lot called failure to launch, which is like you have some positive momentum, but then after college or in the middle of college, like you don't really get a good job and you don't progress in life. But 4 years from now, you feel kind of stuck. How do you know that marijuana is the cause?
I don't.
That's the problem, right? So this is where if you kind of think about it, you said, yeah, there's no short-term consequences, but how do we even know that marijuana is the long-term consequence? So I think the biggest challenge that people face is that we are very good at seeing short-term consequences. And this is the way that our brain works, by the way. And we're very poor at seeing the long-term consequences of our actions, because even for the person who is using marijuana, if you ask them what's wrong in your life right now, they'll say that XYZ is wrong, but the marijuana doesn't appear to have a direct effect on it. And that's the biggest problem.
And so what are your thoughts on marijuana as a whole? Because before we were recording, I was mentioning that, you know, one of my big passions is kind of showcasing the fact that marijuana isn't as good for people's mental health as the internet may present it to be. What are your thoughts as a psychiatrist, as an addiction expert on like marijuana and the brain and mental health?
Yeah. So. Actually, can I add one more bit to that last question?
Sure.
So I think that what I would say to people, if marijuana is contributing to your life being poor, how would you even tell? Right? That's the question. The same question that I would ask you, and I would ask them. And if their answer is, I don't know, then that's a huge problem. Because this is something that could be negatively impacting your life, but you may not be able to see it. And so then that becomes really, really tricky. Like, how do you know? Because if it is a problem and it is keeping you stuck, you wouldn't ever be able to see it, which means that you're never going to fix it, which means that your life will continue to stay exactly the way that it is. So usually what it requires is a period, an extended period of sobriety as an experiment. What will happen to your life if you stop marijuana for like 6 months to a year? We're not talking 30 days, we're talking 6 months to a year. And if someone is not able to engage in that experiment, then that is a sign that there's a problem. Because that's really how long it takes in my experience to really get out of a substance. Now you're asking, what do I think about marijuana? So I think there's a couple things to keep in mind about marijuana. So I think any substance or anything in the world, doesn't matter what it is, has certain good effects and certain bad effects, right? So I know this sounds weird because even working as an addiction psychiatrist, a lot of people are anti-marijuana. There are some studies that show that marijuana can be beneficial. So one study of people who are dependent on opiates found that if you start using marijuana, you can cut your opiate dependency by about 50%. There are some studies, I've had some patients who have been able to use marijuana in a somewhat healthy way to manage, for example, like some aspects of depression or bipolar disorder or anxiety. And you know, some people really find that it can be helpful. I think the challenge is that a lot of the things that people think marijuana do in a negative way is not what I usually see. So some people are worried, they'll say like, oh, like marijuana will make you like stupider and it'll lower your IQ. There's one study, for example, that shows that marijuana is associated with a 4 to 8 point decrease in IQ. But if you say something like that, you know, people will say, but there are lots of very successful people who are super smart who are still using marijuana. Fair enough. There are other studies that show that it doesn't have too much of an effect. So there are a couple of things to keep in mind when it comes to marijuana. The first is that the majority of our studies on marijuana did happen before it was criminalized, at least in the United States, around the 60s and 70s. The marijuana that we get access to today is not the same substance that we got access to 60 years ago, because the potency has increased very, very intensely. So the THC concentration, some of these other compounds in it are way more concentrated. So we see a larger effect. So some of the studies that suggest that it's safe, we're talking about, you know, like, you know, 2 ounces of beer versus 2 ounces of liquor is a very different thing. And marijuana used to be the concentration of beer, and now it's the concentration of like hard liquor. Second thing is that there are a couple of real big problems with marijuana. The first is that it really is a gateway drug. So especially when you start using it in adolescence, one of the biggest problems that I see is that marijuana alters your reward circuitry and your vulnerability to other substances. It sensitizes your dopamine system so that your dopamine system becomes more vulnerable to other addictions. So like you'll actually become more vulnerable to things like video games and stuff like that. And literally like the enjoyment that you get from video games will become altered. The anticipation that you experience will increase. The craving that you will experience will actually intensify. So when you use marijuana, it becomes harder to resist cravings for all other things because it literally alters the chemical structure of your brain and your neurons and stuff in the nucleus accumbens. There's very good evidence for that. So it's not so much the direct effect of marijuana, we'll get to those, but it's that it really makes it gives you a handicap in dealing with other addictive substances. So that's one thing. Okay, so marijuana is not the same concentration. Second thing is it really is a gateway drug in a negative way. The third thing that I really tend to find when I work with people is the reason that marijuana is a problem is not because it's harmful. The reason that marijuana is a problem is because it's helpful. So the hardest patients that I've had to work with as an addiction psychiatrist are not the ones where they use substances and it makes their life wonderful. The hardest cases to kick are when they use substances and it makes their life normal. And this is very true of marijuana. So when I work with people who use marijuana, the hardest cases are not, oh my God, I love marijuana. I love getting high. We're going to like celebrate and have fun and we're going to vibe. It's when I smoke marijuana, or when I use marijuana, I get to live life the way that normal people do. I get to live an ordinary life. I get to hang out with people without crippling anxiety. I get to be able to go to sleep at night like other normal human beings. And this is the real challenge. This is why it's so good and why people like it so much is they do detect that it helps with things like social anxiety. It helps with things like sleep. And if you were to ask someone, hey, I'm going to give you 2 options. One is you can live a life where you don't get to sleep very much and your sleep is crappy and you get to wake up exhausted every day and you don't get to form social connections with people. You don't get to hang out with people. You don't get to date. Or you get to do all of those things. All you have to do is use marijuana. And by the way, it also enhances the pleasure of things like food and video games and sexual activity. Which one would you pick? Right? This is the real challenge, is that it helps people live what they perceive to be normal lives. And in many ways, it does help them live normal lives. So the challenge, though, is that when we start using marijuana to help with those things, it creates other downstream long-term effects. So marijuana may help you fall asleep, but it alters your sleep architecture. It alters your REM sleep. It alters your sleep cycles and makes that sleep less restful. And it also creates other kinds of problems like rebound anxiety. And over time, you develop tolerance. And it's sort of like a double-edged sword is really what I see, which is what makes it so dangerous. And then once you have something that becomes an easy way to fix a problem, then you stop focusing on fixing the problem in a more long-term or healthier way, right? The moment that I use marijuana every night before I go to sleep, sleep hygiene becomes less important. And so the real challenge with marijuana is that it allows you, because it works so well, it actually allows you to propagate unhealthy behaviors. Since it helps me relax and socialize, I don't ever build up my social skills. I don't work on my confidence. I don't go to the gym. I don't learn how to talk to people because the marijuana does everything for me. So marijuana does help. It's just, it's taking the elevator instead of taking the stairs. So it works in the short term, but over time, it's going to make your life harder.
And is the same true for alcohol? Like, I mean, when I heard you describe like the life of, you know, getting high on marijuana and how you're able to date, have fun, socialize, be with your friends, fall asleep faster. I feel like you're also describing the allure to alcohol as well.
Absolutely, right? So I think in alcohol in some ways, I think is like almost more damaging. So I think we have a much clearer relationship between alcohol usage numbing our emotions, especially things like sadness today, but worsens our mood over the course of the next week and the next month. So I think alcohol in some ways is like worse in the sense that the negative health impacts are quite profound. I don't know how to say this. They're more immediate and they seem to be more potent. But alcohol absolutely can serve as a social lubricant. You know, I've even done like couples counseling where like the reason that these people got married in the first place is because of alcohol. And you know, it's such a foundation for their relationship. Two people with social anxiety get together. They both enjoy drinking. They both have somewhat of a biological predisposition. And then when one of them gets sober later in life because it's causing all kinds of other problems, it really creates problems in their relationship because it is the foundation of some of their relationship, right? They, for their honeymoon, they're going to go like on a wine tasting thing in Napa Valley and all this kind of stuff. So it's absolutely true for alcohol as well.
Do you think people's lives will get worse faster if they abuse alcohol compared to marijuana?
I mean, that's such a dangerous question, but my gut instinct is yes. Like alcohol will screw up your life. This is just what I've seen as a clinician. So this is an anecdotal experience, right? So, I mean, just simple things. So if we look at like, you know, health consequences, it's not just that it'll happen faster, it's that it'll screw you up more. So, you know, hepatic steatosis, liver cirrhosis, drunk driving, alcohol withdrawal can be fatal, whereas like marijuana withdrawal is not fatal. Alcohol intoxication is much more likely to be like physically damaging and can be fatal, whereas marijuana intoxication has a much less likely chance of doing so. So from a cytotoxicity, which means the toxicity to your actual cells, I think that alcohol, I mean, we've got some strong evidence that alcohol in that way is worse. And then all the people who like marijuana listening to this are going to be like, yay, I'm in the same, it's okay.
I told you so. No, that's really what I meant, is that I think alcohol will screw your life up more, because it's like, the argument is always like, well, I've never heard anybody's marriage get ruined because of X, Y, and Z, but alcohol has certainly destroyed marriages, or the driving part, or just the how intense it is. And I think it's like, it's so odd to me that it's become so normalized socially, because it's like, we wouldn't do the same thing with something like heroin, and heroin and alcohol, I mean, in my opinion, aren't that far apart as far as like the danger, the potential dangers of abusing them.
I think you can absolutely make that argument.
I know one of the things you talk a lot about is porn and how it impacts the brain. I mean, I think people, maybe a lot of people might not understand, a lot of people might not understand like why people are so drawn to watching porn, other than the fact that somebody might be like lonely, single, or whatever. But I've heard you say that porn really does a fabulous job at turning off our negative emotions. Talk a bit about how porn impacts the brain and why that's just so attractive to people that can't seem to deal with their emotions.
It's such a great question. So I this is a question that I was wondering, right? So we're seeing In our community, we're seeing just a huge uptick in pornography usage. And I was like, what is going on? Like, why is porn, like, what's going on? So I sat down and I did what I was trained to do, right? Which is any good academic doctor is trained to find answers in the literature. So I went to the scientific literature and I tried to understand, okay, which parts of the brain are affected by sex, right? So, and then this is the cool thing is like, when we look at things like, you know, substances of abuse, something like alcohol. So alcohol will affect our GABA receptors. Opioids will affect our mu receptors, kappa receptors. THC will affect our anandamide receptors. They're very focal parts of the brain that are affected by substances. So I was trying to figure out, what does pornography affect? Where's the porn receptor? And that's where what I discovered is, if we really stop and think about it, sex and procreation is arguably the purpose of the human organism. And so every part of our brain is involved in sex. Literally, every part of our brain, every neurotransmitter, if you look at sort of the neuroscience of sexual arousal, sexual engagement, bonding, all that stuff, every part of our brain is affected. So what we see in pornography, and if we kind of think about it from an evolutionary standpoint, like, you know, there's a reason why people can be in like heart failure and still engage in sexual activity, like especially men. And like the gonads still produce sperm, you can still get somewhat of an erection and you can still get like some kind of ejaculation. So our body is willing to sacrifice so much to preserve the ability to procreate. So it is a very, very, very important evolutionary goal. And what pornography basically does is take advantage of this. So if we look at the effect of pornography, I think it's far more whole brain than something like marijuana or alcohol. And this is what we tend to see with all of the behavioral addictions. So these are not substances, but this also happens with things like video games, where there isn't a discrete part of the brain that lights up. We see a more diffuse activity all across the brain. And if we sort of think about it, right, the drive to procreate is so powerful that when you get aroused, you stop thinking about all kinds of other stuff. This is why when people fall in love, they make stupid decisions, right? Because all the other parts, all of your brain becomes aligned towards this one goal. You're thinking about it a lot. You're obsessing about this person. You're falling in love. We romanticize this. But there's a neuroscience component to that, which all gets activated by pornography. So pornography is one of these things that is just such a potent stimulus that is so easily accessible. And furthermore, doesn't frequently come with the consequences that we're talking about. See, no one gets cancer from watching too much pornography. No one gets lung cancer. No one gets liver cirrhosis. You know, no one goes through seizures when they're withdrawing from pornography. So it doesn't come with some of these consequences, and yet it activates, it really suppresses some of our negative emotional circuitry. It gives us spurts of dopamine when we orgasm. Even if you look at some of these ancient yogic texts, they say that orgasm is a state of temporary enlightenment. Because if you really pay attention to the state of mind in orgasm, you have no thoughts, right? It's a moment of pure bliss. So if you kind of think about people who get addicted to things like opioids or alcohol or marijuana, what are they trying to do? They're trying to get away from their thoughts. They're trying to get away from their mind. And the moment of orgasm is a very powerful physiological and neurological way to get out of all that stuff. So it's just a very potent kind of physiologic neuroscientific tool to help us feel better.
So then would you say there's a big misconception that people think that the majority of people who are watching and engaging in porn are just unhappy with their sex life, they're feeling lonely, they're not in a relationship, and in fact, the reality is it's just giving them this massive cure to all the negative emotions in their life?
I'd say yes and no. So you're absolutely right that I think it is solving more than loneliness for sure. But remember that, see, this is the problem with all these technological interventions that we have now, pornography, video games, whatever, social media. See, the reason that these things are growing is because they scratch an evolutionary itch. So our brain has a desire for relationships. We have all kinds of circuits in our brain that measure our social status compared to other people. They can induce anxiety. They can help us feel comfortable. This stuff is very deeply wired. The problem with technology is that it gives us a shadow, but it does give us something. It gives us a shadow of what the real world provides. So, you know, I have relationships with people online that I would consider very real friends of mine. I emotionally bond with these people. And so I can get some very real value out of this thing. The problem is that it never gives us the complete real life version. So just if we look at friends, for example, I can talk to my friends online and we can work through a breakup together, right? So let's say I get dumped and they provide emotional support. That's very real. And if you look at, for example, the social networks of gamers during the pandemic, gamers were actually resilient against the early stages of depression and anxiety because we actually had a social support network that was virtual, so we were fine not leaving the house. The challenge, though, is if you look at that online relationship, I can't get everything. So when I hug another human being, I get a release of oxytocin. That makes me feel good. It makes me feel bonded. It alleviates some degree of stress. But you can't hug yourself, right? So there's something that's always missing. So this is the challenge with something like pornography. And this is becoming more of a problem, not just with pornography, but with some of these like social media aspects of pornography, like OnlyFans, because now we're seeing the development of parasocial relationships. So it's not just the direct neuroscientific effect of sexual activity. Now I can interact with this person. I can get their attention. I can pay extra money to have them call me out specifically. At the beginning of a video, they're going to say, "Hey, I made this for you." And that scratches more itches in the brain. So we're seeing that pornography is evolving. And I think as it scratches those itches, as I'm getting my needs met through the pornography, that will propagate my loneliness. Because just like marijuana or anything else, I'm not actually fixing those problems in my life. So it creates this kind of dependency that keeps people stuck, because my brain is not, I don't know if this kind of makes sense, but see, if my brain gets none of its needs met, it will work really hard to get its needs met, right? So if I'm absolutely starving and absolutely like thirsty, I will do whatever it takes. But if I have something that gives me some amount of water, then I will never be desperate enough to actually fix the situation, because I'm getting enough of it kind of handed to me in a very easy way. And that's what pornography does.
So I want to dive into like things like social media and even like Netflix, because what you just said about like giving it like this instant fix, right? And dealing with loneliness. I think social media can certainly do that too. Like personally, like I found that like if a post or a video does really well, like I get this massive dopamine rush. And then if one doesn't, I'm like, oh, like bummer, right? And I think that's common amongst people in the content creation space. And I also know people that when they are lonely, because of the fact you can just binge Netflix shows, you could sit there all day and check out and just watch like your favorite show over and over again for days on end. So do you put stuff like that in the same category as porn in the way that it impacts the brain, or is it slightly different?
I would say it's different. So some things are similar and some things are the same, right? So it's not going to engage all the same circuits that pornography does. It'll activate different things. But we're starting to see, especially with things like OnlyFans, like we're seeing that blending, right? So there's a social media component that's combining with pornography. But as you mentioned, so social media activates all kinds of other circuitry. So there's this kind of, human beings are acutely aware of like what their status is in relation to other human beings. And this is what social media really like picks up on. So we you know, the challenge is that in the past, we had no way to quantify our social status. Like I didn't actually have like a social rating. But with the creation of things like social networks, we can literally quantify how much people like you, right? There's like a literal button called a like. And that is something that is very, very like addictive in a sense, right? Because now we know exactly what we need to do to get more likes. We have a quantification of something that used to be like hard to understand. How do I get more people to like me? What do I do? It's kind of confusing, but social media really taps into that.
So what do you think is the remedy or the solution for all of this? Because as somebody who's been in recovery for over 15 years, I know that substances and external things like we've been talking about provide this an immense amount of value to our lives, and they're highly addictive, and the feeling is highly addictive. And at the same time, the further down the addiction path we go, the more shame we develop and the lower our self-esteem becomes. So now you're at this horrible crossroads where you're highly addicted to something that makes you feel really good and you feel like crap about yourself and you have no confidence in your ability to change. So how does somebody handle that?
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So that's the problem. The problem with the addiction is that when you're done with using, you create a worse situation that requires you to use. So you have a bunch of shame. So you need some kind of substance to make the shame go away. We absolutely see that going on with technology. So I would say, and this is kind of where I take like a yogic perspective, and I think there's a reason why if you look at like the evolution of psychotherapy and psychiatry, basically there's something going on right now called the third wave of psychotherapy. The third wave of psychotherapy is the incorporation of certain like Eastern concepts into clinical treatment. So we have these things like dialectical behavioral therapy, which includes a lot of mindfulness. We have things like acceptance and commitment therapy, which is a very good evidence-based treatment for addictions. And so we're starting to incorporate some of these Eastern concepts. And I think the most important thing is that if we look at what all of these things do, what they do is externalize our attention. We spend less time with ourselves and we spend more time with the outside world. And this is creating all kinds of other problems that we haven't even touched on. See, when I'm not in touch with myself, I don't know what I want. Right? And if I don't know what I want, what I end up doing is looking to the external world, looking for successful people. And then I say, okay, well, this person is happy. This person is successful. That's what I should do. And then we start to do that, but we don't actually feel that internally. We have a question mark in here and we're looking for answers on the outside. And then once we start duplicating what that person is doing, then it doesn't work the same, because the that person was passionate. That's why they got there. But I'm not passionate. I'm just mimicking what they're doing. So this is kind of what ends up happening, is we're kind of directionless in life. We don't really know what we want. And then in that directionlessness, our brain is kind of like, why not get some dopamine today? Because I'm not working towards anything in particular. And if you look at there's some really interesting multivariate regression analyses on risk factors for pornography addiction. So what correlates with pornography addiction? And the number one thing that I've sort of found in the literature doesn't say necessarily that this is number one, but this is what I think is really important. There's very strong correlation, is meaninglessness in life. And you know, I know you struggled with substances in the past. And if you really like look at every single person who's overcome an addiction, a big part of it is you have to have a really good reason to. You have to care more about fixing the addiction than what the addiction provides. And right now we're such a purposeless society. It's like, what do I want to accomplish a year from now? Who the hell knows? Right. And then we go on like replacing, finding this answer from the outside, but we're not in touch with ourselves. And so I think the most important thing that needs to happen is we need to get back in touch with ourselves. Stop running away from our emotions, connect with what we want. Because when I work with people who are addicted to pornography, on any given day, it's just not worth it to avoid porn. It's not like they move towards something significant. The cost is not that high. I might as well watch a little bit of porn, maybe jerk off a little bit, maybe masturbate a little bit. And then I can go on to the empty life. You know, the life is empty before and the life is empty after. There's no cost, really. And so a big part of it, I think, is just re-internalizing our attention, connecting with ourselves, becoming like grounded. And this is something that I think is incredibly important, because technology is only going to get more addictive. Like, it's not like one day some platform is going to wake up and say, oh, you know what? This is addictive enough. On the contrary, they're all competing for our attention. What's happening right now is all the platforms are trying to pull users towards their platform and pull people away from other platforms, which is what they're designed to do. I mean, I don't think that that's evil. It's just, you know, anytime you have a marketplace, everyone wants you to use their product. That's their goal. The problem is, no matter which platform wins, you lose, because you're losing the attention no matter what. So what we really need to do is reconnect with ourselves, spend a little bit more time with ourselves, learn to work through emotions as opposed to numb them, right? Try to figure out what we want instead of letting social media tell us the ways in which we're deficient and how we can spend $59.99 to fix that problem. Right? This is exactly what's going on. And so what we really need to do is get connected with ourselves, because even social media will create things like body dysmorphia, right? There's a really disturbing trend that we're seeing where body dysmorphia used to be more common in women, and we're starting to see equality between men and women. And men have a lot more body dysmorphia than I think historically they've ever had. And so that's all because we're making our sense of self is being dictated by what we consume from the outside. It's not being developed from in here.
We've talked about how a lot of these substances and things can lead to being addicted to the other things that we've talked about, like porn can be intertwined, you know, with like weed and video games and alcohol, and they all can be connected somehow. As far as the solution for this, I know you're talking about the importance of getting connected to ourselves and developing some purpose in life, which I know is incredibly important. There's also been a lot of talk about like dopamine detox. Do you think, given that these addictions can be related, do you think it's important for somebody to essentially just detox from everything and really focus on finding themselves? Or do you think that there can be a happy medium with like watching like some content like you and others that are genuinely helping people overcome addiction? I'm always on the lookout to keep my immune system strong while I travel, juggle multiple businesses, and manage my stress. I noticed that some of my friends were using an incredible product called Armour Colostrum, so I decided to give it a try. To be fully transparent, I haven't been using it for that long. However, I've been on the road a lot since starting it, and I haven't been sick at all. Armour Colostrum is a proprietary concentrate of bovine colostrum that harnesses over 400 functional nutrients to strengthen your immune barriers, your body's inside suit of armor, and first line of defense against harmful particles from the environment that can trigger inflammation and make you sick. So essentially, it can strengthen your immunity, ignite your metabolism, fortify gut health, promote hair growth, and power fitness performance and recovery. As someone who hates being sick and works out every day, I certainly feel more confident now that I'm taking Armour Colostrum. So together, Armour and I have worked out a special offer for my audience so that you can receive 15% off your first order.
Go to tryarmra.com/Doug or enter Doug to get 15% off your first order. Again, it's tryarmra.com/Doug or enter Doug to get 15% off your first order. That's tryarmra.com/Doug. Now back to the show.
Yeah, so that's a great question. So there are a couple of different, let's say, like neuroscience, psychiatric things going on, okay? So the first, let's talk about dopamine detox. So see, when we use any kind of substance or even activity, our brain will develop tolerance and we will need a higher signal. So if we look at something like pornography, what we tend to find is that over time, people will change the way that they watch pornography. Pornography consumption tends to get hardcore over time. So things will become more extreme. And that's because in order to get the same stimulus from the brain, so when we get some amount of stuff, and it's the same thing with like caffeine or alcohol, right? So at the beginning, like I'm a lightweight and two beers will get me drunk. And then like as I develop physiologic tolerance, I need three, I need four, I need five. Same thing happens with video games. So if you pay attention to people who play video games, the first hour or two that you play is really, really fun. And then the subsequent hours that you play are less fun, but you can't seem to stop. So when we talk about dopamine detox, the way that I sort of think about it is resetting your sensitivity to dopamine by abstaining from certain dopaminergic activities for some amount of time. That can be very, very helpful. It's basically resetting your neurochemistry. But I'm a big fan of not abstinence when it comes to behavioral stuff. So when I work with people, so abstinence from things like marijuana, alcohol, opioids, caffeine, go for it, right? You don't need that stuff to survive. But when we look at things like behavioral addictions, things like sex addiction or social media addiction, unfortunately, we live in a world where these have become part of life. So I was talking to a second grade teacher and they told me that 100% of the boys in their class play Fortnite. So if you're the one boy in the class who does not play Fortnite, you are denied a social experience with your peers. So it's here and here to stay. So this is where I think it's fine to detox for a while. And there are some places out there that will do this kind of like, you know, these video game addiction like rehabs where you have 30 days of sobriety and it's built on the sobriety model, which I think is fine. But then the problem is when these people are done, like they go back into the world and like sobriety is hard, especially when it comes to technology. So our approach is to teach restraint instead of restriction. What I believe you should be able to do is develop an internal relationship with yourself and to get your psychological needs met in real life so that all this stuff becomes recreation. So I literally failed out of college because I was addicted to video games, and I still play video games and I teach my kids how to play video games, but there's a healthy way to do it. And the core problem with a lot of these things is that they start to become the primary source of the way that we get our needs met. So if my main method of managing my emotions is playing video games, then anytime there's negative emotion, I have to play video games, and that's going to create the cycle we talked about. So now, for example, I go for a walk every day. And if I go for a walk every day, I don't listen to anything. I don't talk to anyone. I just let my mind run wild. And it thinks through all the problems that I have. And over time, I kind of calm down. And then I feel emotionally better. And then you can play video games. Fine. And then I'll come home. I'll settle whatever I need to. Then I have play video games for a little bit. And then it's fine. So I think that we can detox to recalibrate. Absolutely. But I think long-term, we need a sustainable way to live our life that does not fall victim to technology. See, we should have enough resistance to it to where we don't need to avoid it. We can manage it.
So I know you found a lot of purpose in your pain and your past and your experience with video game addiction drives a lot of what you do now. I'm curious, like, what were video games doing for you as a kid? Like, what pain, what problems were they numbing for you?
Yeah, so I think they were doing a lot more than numbing my problems. So I think the first thing that I realize now is, so I skipped a grade early on, which I know a lot of like type A parents are really proud of. They're like, oh yeah, my kid is smarter than all the other kids. I think that had a lot of damaging effects for me. So the first thing to understand is that when you're in school, your social status, usually, at least when I was in school, as a boy, relates to your physical capability, not your mental capability. If you're the smartest kid in the class, you get bullied. You get called teacher's pet. the kids who have a high social status are the ones that are like play football. And, you know, at the beginning of PE class, you divide into two teams. There's two team captains. Your social status is determined by how quickly you get picked for either team. So I was the last kid to get picked because I was a year younger. I was a 5-year-old competing against sometimes 7-year-olds. Like, that's crazy. Like, there's just no way you can win. So I grew up in a scenario where I could not compete. Right? I was just a loser, like objectively, all the time. I would be at the bottom. So video games offered me the first avenue for a level playing field. Because if I was playing a video game, a 5-year-old can beat a 7-year-old with like enough practice because it's just cognitive. It's just reflexes. So it allowed me to get some degree of social identity. Second thing that happened was that I found school to be incredibly boring because school moves at the pace of the slowest kid. And the cool thing about video games is when you beat level 1, level 2 is waiting for you. When you beat level 2, level 3 is waiting for you. So I found a constant level of intellectual challenge and engagement, which I absolutely fell in love with. So this is where the roots of my addiction were formed. It allowed me to compete against my peers. It allowed me to feel challenged instead of bored. Later on, what ended up happening is that, you know, I started to do poorly in life. And then I fell into this trap of like numbing my emotions by playing video games. And I remember like when I would go to bed when I was a freshman in college and literally failing out of school, like it hadn't happened yet because it was mid-semester. I remember going to bed and realizing like I'm failing out and there's like nothing I can do about it. Like I felt completely powerless. So those thoughts would come roaring back when I went to sleep. And I would feel so guilty, feel so powerless. It was just so painful. So the only antidote that I had is I had to play video games until I was so exhausted that I would just pass out the moment that my head hit the pillow. So the only way, and that video games are good at that. Like there's even a, you know, a case from 2012 where someone died of a cardiac arrhythmia after gaming for like 60 hours straight. So they can suppress your physiologic signals. They can keep you going for long, long, long periods of time. And so then what would happen is since I would play to the level of exhaustion, then I'm going to sleep at 4:30 in the morning and then I'm sleeping through all my classes. It makes it impossible to wake up. Now there's another day that I've slept through all my classes. My grades have dropped a little bit more because I'm after the fourth day of class that you miss, you lose like 3 points on your final average and things like that. Like it was really terrible. And so then I just got stuck in the cycle where like the only thing that I could do to avoid my pain was play video games. And then it even reached the point I was so desperate that what I would do is sneak when I went home for like a break after the semester, I would sneak out in the morning and steal my transcript from the mailbox so that my parents didn't see it. And then my parents would ask me like, where's your grades? And they're like, I was like, oh, they send them at the end of the year in college. It's different. And they're like, oh, okay. So I was just delaying and playing tricks and playing video games and screwing up my life.
I've heard you say that your journey began at failure. A lot of people's journeys end at failure and they give up on themselves. How did you use, you know, failing out of college and your experience with what you just described to propel you to do essentially what you're doing now?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think the first thing to keep in mind is, see, what's the difference between a failure and a setback? If it's your last data point, it's a failure, right? Because that's when the game is over. That's when it's a loss. But if you keep going afterward, it's a setback. So also, like I remember when I was applying to medical school for the third year in a row. So I'd been rejected from about 80 medical schools at this point. And my uncle came to me and he's like, bro, you got to think about doing something else. Maybe get a PhD, like maybe do something else because this isn't working. For 2 years, all you've done is apply to medical school. You haven't gotten into a single one. Like, I don't know that the third year is going to be any different, right? Because those Fs from college stay with you. It's not like they disappear after some number of years. And so at that point, you know, we kind of had a conversation about how I was stubborn. And so what's the difference between stubborn and perseverant? Right? If you win in the end, they call you, they say, oh, look at this person has perseverance. If you lose in the end, they call you stubborn. Or if you quit, they call you stubborn. They were like, you're so stubborn, you should have. So this is really bizarre, where stubborn and perseverant are the same. Setback and failure are the same. There's no such thing as a failure, in my opinion. There's just what happens, right? And then there's what you do with it. So this is where I think for me, it was a big part of it was just sort of recognizing this, that this is my life. This is what happened. It's neither good nor bad. It's made me the person that I am today, which sounds really, really confusing, right? So people will say like, what do you mean there's no such thing as failure? There's literally an F on your transcript. And this is where I didn't understand this, but there was no scenario in which I thought failing out of college is better than getting a 4.0 GPA. You ask 99, 100% of people, I imagine they'll say 4.0 is better than 2.0. Except what's really bizarre is now a big part of my brand is that I went from failing out and graduating with a 2.5 to training and teaching at Harvard Medical School. So like this is the one scenario where I'm not a 4.0 kid. I'm actually a degenerate loser who failed out. And that's all a part of my journey. And so for other people out there to recognize that your failures turn you into the person that you are. Do they cost you certain things? Absolutely. Will they make your life difficult? Absolutely. There's no question about that. But we even know from studies on things like peer support, that if we look at things like especially like sobriety, I can train at the best institution on the planet and become an addiction psychiatrist, but there is something that I cannot provide for my patients that someone who has been an alcoholic can, right? So when one alcoholic supports another, they know what it's like. And there's no substitute for your experience. So even your failures turn you into the person that you are. And I think at the end of the day, the only thing that you can do, whether you succeed or you fail, the next day you wake up, your options are very simple, right? You can just keep continue going. Whether you fail today or you succeed today, the way in which you keep going may change. But there's only one direction to move. Life is going to move you forward whether you want to or not. Time will tick whether you want to stay in the same place. So just focus on moving forward, and that's all you can do, whether you get a setback or not.
So do you think success can be unhealthy? Because I think of what the opposite of failure is, it's typically success. And I heard you when you were describing the level one, level two of the video, playing the video games. I think people do that as well. They're like, okay, I want to make $100,000 a year. Do that. Now it's up to 150, 200, or I want to get X amount of followers or progress like in my career at this corporate level or whatever. Do you think that like success can be addictive too?
100%. So just ask ourselves, right? Doug, can you think of anyone who's very successful who committed suicide?
You can.
Yeah, right? So everyone can. It's great, yeah. Right? So you look at all these people who are very successful and ask yourself how many of them do you think are happy, right? How many of them engage in unhealthy habits? So there's even studies that support this. So I went to medical school at this place called Tufts University School of Medicine, and then I did my psychiatry training at Harvard. And what I found is that at Harvard, there's way more imposter syndrome than there is at Tufts. I did my undergrad at University of Texas. I didn't really know what imposter syndrome looked like back then. But generally speaking, the higher you climb, the more vulnerable you are to imposter syndrome. So there are all kinds of negative things that can come with success. We can get imposter syndrome. We can develop ego. We can develop what you just pointed out as well, which is this concept of moving goalposts. So if my goal is 100,000 and then do I get content at 100,000? No, now it's 150. Once I get 150, is that enough? No, then it's 200. So there was a period of time where in my private practice, 30 to 40% of my patients were in finance. So these were people at like Goldman Sachs and like making millions, tens of millions of dollars a year, and they were still very unhappy. So you can chase success, and there's objective value to success. I'm not saying don't be successful. But I think what makes something healthy or unhealthy is not success or failure, because we just talked about, and it was a beautiful question from you, right? So if failure can be healthy, can success be unhealthy? Absolutely. So the main thing is who's in control. So there's no such thing as healthy emotions or unhealthy emotions. What makes an emotion healthy or unhealthy is who's in control. So if the sadness is in control of you, then it's going to be unhealthy. And this is where we can even look at things like excitement and love. Aren't those good emotions? Well, it depends on who's in control. If I've been married for 15 years and I have two 12-year-old twins and I fall in love with someone else, is that love a good love or a bad love? Well, that depends on who's in control. If I get really excited about this thing, oh, I want to learn to play guitar, and then I order a guitar off of Amazon and I buy all this sheet music and things like that, is that good or bad? Well, it depends who's in control. So if the success is in control of you, which I tend to find for a lot of people happens, the more successful you are, the more likely it is that success will be controlling your life. that the way that you feel about yourself, your sense of identity, you can't stop. You can't be at peace. Because if you are unsuccessful, then you become unhappy. And now what's happened is that your unhappiness is not yours to control. It's controlled by the outcomes. So I worked with an Olympic athlete. And, you know, they really loved being a good Olympic athlete. They derived a lot of their pleasure and enjoyment and identity in life from being number one. The problem is, even if you're an Olympic athlete, it's not like you're going to be the gold medalist every single year, right? And I remember reading like an article where even like Michael Phelps like struggled with suicidality, which is like really confusing for a lot of people. It makes perfect sense to me, right? So once you work with these people, you'll see this. That at the end of the day, if success is the source of your happiness, then the source of your happiness is not in your control because you don't get to decide whether you're successful. Someone can show up who has some bizarre genetic mutation that allows them to their muscles to do this particular thing, or they can oxygenate faster, and then you'll be a silver medalist or bronze medalist. So every year goes by, you get a little bit older. So success can absolutely be unhealthy. And the main thing, anything can be unhealthy. It's just who's in control of what. That's ultimately what determines whether something is healthy or unhealthy.
Speaking of suicide, I was shocked a few months ago. I was looking at suicide stats and learned that, like, I think it's like 4 out of every 5 suicides is male. And I knew it was higher in men, but I was shocked that it was that high. Over the last several years, a lot more men have been open about their struggles with mental health. They've been more willing to go to therapy. But yet, I don't think the problem's getting any better, at least from what I can see, at least right now. What are your thoughts on the current mental health of men, and how can we do better to help them?
I made a couple of disturbing discoveries. I don't know if this is 100% correct, but there's one study that shows that above 50% of men who commit suicide have no evidence of mental illness. So this is where a lot of people will default to, okay, there's an underdiagnosis of mental illness in men because men are less likely to seek help and things like that, which is absolutely true. But we have to consider that men are killing themselves not because they're mentally ill. We have to consider that as a possibility, right? And we know that historically, like, I remember my favorite book is Count of Monte Cristo. And there's a great line in there where someone is about to commit suicide. And what they kind of say is like, blood washes out dishonor. So if you look at it historically, like men have committed suicide to, I don't know, like remedy themselves, regain their honor. In some cultural context, suicide is like acceptable. So I think one of the real things that we really need to acknowledge, and this is the craziest thing, is in my clinical experience, I'll work with some men who I honestly do not think have like a mood disorder. They're not bipolar. They don't have major depressive disorder. They may be depressed. They don't have like schizophrenia or something like that. Like, they genuinely look at their lives and they feel completely trapped. They feel like there's no way that this is going to get better. And they have tried and tried and tried. And so this is a very, very, very interesting thing to consider. But I think we sort of have to do this, where we have to acknowledge that, see, if men are historically committing suicide, there's one of two possibilities. One is that they're mentally ill, which is absolutely the case in some cases. But then the other thing we need to understand is anytime you have an epidemiological effect, it doesn't necessarily mean that there's an illness. What this also means is that the lives that men live are, from their perspectives, genuinely not worth living. Right? So they don't see a path towards joy or success in their life. And it's very arrogant for us to be living our lives and say that, yes, there is a path for you. I personally believe that. But, you know, we have to really like listen to the experiences that men are having today when men are getting crushed. Like, because I think this is where there are a couple of really interesting differences amongst men. So men are, generally speaking, a group of people who we say they should help themselves. People don't take responsibility for men's well-being. We'll take responsibility for other groups' well-being, right? So and it's not to say that women have it easy or anything like that, but certain kinds of minorities and women and children, right? So like, even when we sort of think about the Titanic, it's women and children onto the lifeboats. The men get fucked. Like, that's just how it is, right? So this is what we do in society. Like, if you look at things like military draft, it's okay for men to die. And even men are okay with this. Like, I remember when I was working on an inpatient bipolar disorders unit with acute mania, when anytime a patient was violent, the nurses never went and got my female colleagues. They would come and get me. Like, It's just assumed. Like, no one even pays attention to it. No one even acknowledges it. There's just this unspoken rule that, like, if someone needs to handle it, it should be men. And there are other ways that, you know, there are unspoken rules for women as well, right? So in terms of, like, the cognitive load of, like, managing a house and organizing things, I'm not saying that it's women don't have it bad. But if we look at male mental health, I think there are a lot of things that we do. A big part of it is that we expect men to be independent and self-sufficient. We don't go out of our way to try to help men. We just expect them to be able to help themselves. So if you look at things like, I remember there's a fantastic program that was run by a bank where I had a patient where, you know, if a woman has a kid and they're out of the workforce, this is like a big disadvantage to their career. And there's this awesome program that a bank put on that will help you like get back to where you were and will help you reintegrate into the workforce, will provide you with additional support if you've been out of work for like 3 years because you had children. It's an awesome program. I'm in favor of it 100%. There's nothing like that for men, right? And you may say, well, men don't have kids. Fair enough. But if a man falls behind in life, there's no resource out there that says we're going to work hard to help you. Even today, I think 60% of people in college, at least in the United States, who graduate and or are students are women, but there aren't really programs to help men get into college, right? There aren't male-only scholarships. So we're seeing that there's very little societal support for men. And then there's all kinds of other things that are changing. So there's an expectation for independence. There's an expectation for self-sufficiency. And so there's all kinds of challenges that we're running into at the societal level. And then there's all kinds of specific clinical stuff. Like we teach men. So here's like one last thing that I'll mention. So there's this thing in the psychiatric literature called normative male alexithymia. So alexithymia is color blindness to your internal emotional state. So we don't know what we feel as men. And the reason we call it normative male alexithymia is because it is actually normal for men to be alexithymic. So men are not taught about what their emotions are, how to feel them, etc. And so what tends to happen is that men lack a skill that is very crucial for success in life, which is to understand what your emotions are, how to manage them, and how to get them under control. Instead, we're colorblind to them, and they tend to like wreak havoc on our lives. And we don't even realize what's going on. There's a lot of self-blame. We sort of see procrastination. Procrastination, a third of the time to 50% of the time, is an emotion that you're unaware of. So as you fix that emotional colorblindness, men's lives improve. There's all kinds of like at different levels.
So do you think therapy is effective for men? Because I feel like a lot of the problems that you're describing when men are experiencing these, or when people experience these things, somebody's like, well, just go to therapy. A therapist will be able to help you.
Yeah. So I think therapy can be very effective for men. So I'm a therapist. I've had, you know, half of my patients roughly have been men, and I think it's been very effective. So therapy remains the best evidence-based answer that we have for mental illness. Okay, fair enough. The problem is that it doesn't work for a lot of people. And there's a couple reasons for that. The first is that I don't know that therapists are taught specifically how to work with men. So for example, there are a couple of big biases in therapy. The first is that in therapy, we talk a lot about feelings. But there's data that shows that estrogen literally increases your awareness of your internal emotional state. So when you ask a man, like, how do you feel? Half the men in the world don't know how to answer that. Or they'll say frustrated or angry. And so the experience of a lot of men is that they go to therapy and they like, there's even a really great paper on couples counseling and why men are reluctant to go to couples counseling. And what men describe is that they're entering into a field where they don't know how to play the game. It's like going onto the basketball court and not knowing how to dribble. So the experience of a lot of men is that they don't know how to articulate their emotions the way that their female partner does. This is a study looking at heteronormative relationships. And so they feel like outgunned because they don't know how to participate in therapy. There's also a lot of other problems that I think we see. One is that even though therapy is the best evidence-based answer we've got on average, there's a lot of data that shows that emotions are not just in your head, right? They're also in your body. And if we look at culturally sensitive studies of men's emotional experiences. And we do this for everybody else, right? We'll do like culturally sensitive psychiatry for immigrants, culturally sensitive psychiatry for people who are, you know, not heterosexual. And that's all good stuff. But now we need to do this for men too. What we discover is that a lot of men will say, just lift, bro. And what I think a big thing that we'll sort of find is that the way that men deal with their emotions is much more physically. So when I work with men, I won't ask them how they feel in their mind. I'll ask them, what do you feel in your body? And they'll see, I feel a crushing pressure on my chest. And then I will ask them the question, what emotion do you think maps onto that physical feeling? And they'll say, like, I don't know, maybe panic, maybe fear. And this is the beautiful thing is when you ask them, then I'll ask them, are you feeling panicked? Are you feeling fear, afraid? Are you feeling sad? And they're like, yes, I'm feeling all three of those things. It's so confusing because we don't just feel one at the same time. So there's a specific way that we can work with emotions. There are certain kinds of psychotherapy that I think may be more effective for men. And furthermore, there are other kinds of mental wellness or emotional wellness interventions that may be outside of psychotherapy that will be very beneficial for men that we generally don't use. And so I think this needs to change.
Which emotional well-being interventions are you referring to?
So I think physicality is a huge part of it. So like, you know, when I work with men, like not just as a psychiatrist, but there are times where I've done things like run retreats. And even I was like a camp counselor. And like, you know, we can, there's a huge difference between, okay, if there's a dude who has low self-esteem, we can go to my office, you can sit down on the couch and we'll talk to you about your feelings. And hopefully over time, we'll help you develop confidence in yourself. There's absolutely value to that. But there is no substitute to going to an obstacle course that you cannot finish. And working with you for 3 months to where you can climb a rope 50 feet in the air and ring a bell. There is no substitute to accomplishment. And I think this is where we kind of fall short, that a lot of the men that I work with, you know, my goal is to help them achieve their goals. Like, we can talk about your feelings. Like, that's fine. We do that. It's very important. But there's also a lot of value to, you know, developing emotions, not just by processing negative ones, but let's help you build a life that is worth living. And there's even studies that show that men are more responsive to something called instrumental support as opposed to emotional support. So when a man has a problem, they may not gravitate towards talking about the problem because the man will say, like, I don't understand what it does. Like, if I'm single and lonely, how does going to a therapist once a week and talking about my loneliness find me a romantic partner? I want a way to feel connected to another human being. And this is why they go to people like dating coaches and stuff like that. So I think that we have to acknowledge that the solutions that work for men may be a little bit different from traditional therapy. Doesn't mean that traditional therapy isn't good or can't be very helpful. And keep in mind, I say this as someone who does psychotherapy with men all the time, right? Can be helpful. But I think what we really need to do is, just like every other subset of the population, we need to recognize that this is not a one-size-fits-all situation. And that what we really need to do is help men in the way that they are asking for help. Instead of telling these men, this is not the right way for you to get help. You should get help by talking about your emotions, which there's value to. There's no question. But I think this is something that needs to change.
There can be a blend of both, like the just lift, bro, getting physical, getting yourself into shape, doing things that challenge you can be very helpful while also engaging in some form of psychotherapy to help them tap into their emotions, right?
Absolutely. And not only do I think that both are possible, I think the two work really well when you use them together. So let's talk about your emotions. Let's understand how your emotions interfere with your goals. Let's gain mastery over your emotions so that they no longer hinder you in accomplishing what you want. But you can't just ignore them, because otherwise you'll never get your ass to the gym in the first place, or you'll feel intimidated when you go. You'll feel like a loser. That's an emotion. So that emotion is keeping you from accomplishing your goals. Let's work through it and then get to your goal.
Well, Dr. K, this has been awesome. Very helpful conversation. I think my audience is going to get a ton of value out of this. If people aren't watching your stuff already, where's the best place for them to go? Where can they get a copy of your book? All that stuff.
Yeah, so they can find us. I think YouTube is a great place to start. We're HealthyGamerGG. There's also our website, which is healthygamer.gg. You know, our philosophy, by the way, we built a coaching program, which has been incredibly successful. It has been 99% full for about 18 months. And we've helped about 16,000 or 18,000 people at this point. So if this philosophy like resonates with people, that's one of the things that we do. I also wrote a book about parenting, which I know sounds kind of weird. But I'd say the biggest thing about that book, which is How to Raise a Healthy Gamer, is that we teach a lot of emotional and communication skills that I think a lot of people could really, really benefit from. This is sort of in the guise of how to raise your kid so that they're not as vulnerable to all these technology addiction things that we talked about. The book is also very effective for people who have siblings or even parents or nieces and nephews who you may see a problem with. And then if people want to learn kind of our approach and our style, you can find that in the book as well.
Awesome. I'll be sure to include the links to that stuff in the show notes. And thank you once again for coming on. Like I said, the audience is going to love this one.
Thanks a lot, Doug. Love the work that you do, man.
Thank you.